Welcome to the Best of the Left podcast, with clips today from Ring of Fire, The Young Turks, On the Media, and Slate Magazine.
Joining us now is Dave Lindorf, co-author of a new book, The Case for Impeachment, The Legal Argument for Removing George W. Bush from Office. Dave Lindorf is a veteran investigative journalist, and his co-author, Barbara Olshansky, is a respected civil rights lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Dave, thanks so much for joining us on Ring of Fire.
Thanks for having me on again.
But first of all, tell us what impeachment is. What are the historical antecedents for it?
A lot of people have become misled about what impeachment's all about because of the aberration of the Clinton impeachment. What happened during the Clinton impeachment was people focused on this notion that the president lied under oath and therefore he should be impeached because he violated the law. But the founding fathers really made it clear during their debates over the impeachment provision, which they considered to be an extremely important part of the Constitution. They made it clear that they were talking about political crimes. I mean, clearly, if the president commits murder or does some heinous crime that violates a federal statute or state statute, that would be ample reason to impeach. But they went way beyond that, that by saying high crimes and misdemeanors, the context of those words in that time referred clearly to political crimes. I think the better model that people need to have in mind when they think impeachment is the Nixon impeachment. If you look at the articles that were voted out...
And Nixon technically was not impeached.
That's right. And he actually resigned because it became clear that, I mean, Republicans actually voted for the impeachment articles in the House Judiciary Committee, and his own friends told him that he was going to lose in the Senate and get removed from office because the charges were so serious and clear.
The Republicans, incidentally, were led by Pete McCloskey, who today is running for Congress again against Congressman Pombo in California. But Pete McCloskey is one of the great figures of American history, wonderful integrity, and was willing to lead the charge against President Nixon based upon the integrity issue.
And of course, Republicans like Lowell Weicker and Howard Baker were also really coming very heavily against the Nixon presidency during the impeachment hearings. But the important point to look at is that Nixon's impeachment was for, among other things, lying to the American people, which is not a crime. But if that lie is about something of consequence that leads to some terrible action, such as lying to get us into the war or lying about the nature of the NSA spying on Americans, these are of major consequence.
It's more about an abuse of power.
That's precisely what the founding fathers were afraid of, and it's why that in the very article that defines the power of the president, they included the impeachment clause, which said that Congress could remove the president, because they were really terrified of a return to a tyrant, and they saw the presidency as the place where that would happen. And it's what we're sort of seeing happen now when you have a president who asserts the right to, at his own discretion, ignore 750 acts that were passed by Congress. I mean, this is the ultimate abuse of power. He said that Congress doesn't matter. I am the decider. So impeachment is about political crimes. That's the key. And so we found five broad areas of impeachable crimes by this president.
We'll talk about some of the worst ones.
There's two issues here. One is what's the most serious, and the other is what's the most likely to lead to an impeachment, because clearly the most serious is the war. The president is, I think, unarguably in violation of the Nuremberg Charter, which the U.S. was the prime author of, which says that a war of aggression against a country that doesn't pose a threat is the ultimate crime. It's called a crime against peace. And this president clearly did that.
But you can make a case against them, but also there's a very strong case in his defense, because his attorneys would argue that his actions were justified by Saddam Hussein's violation of the various orders of the Security Council, which were the conditions for the peace treaty during the first Gulf War, that Saddam Hussein violated the terms of that treaty, and that alone justified his deposition.
But that would only have been true if the UN were to have certified that it had been a UN action, which it wasn't. The Nuremberg Charter makes it clear that the only justification for war is in defense against immediate threat. And that's the wording. And it was not an immediate threat, even if there'd been weapons of mass destruction and a nuclear program. It wasn't an immediate threat, which is worth bearing in mind as we look at Iran. There is no immediate threat in either case. It wasn't justified because he wasn't even close to making a bomb. The UN Charter says you have to take steps to try to deal with these things unless it's an immediate threat. I mean, having an reactor is a long way from having a bomb. But my point was that the war is the most serious crime, as are the violations of the Geneva Accord involving torture and rendition. But I think realistically, you're not going to see an American president impeached for being a war criminal. No country has really convicted its own leader of being a war criminal, although many should have been. Probably the most serious crime that this president has committed that would be, I think, impeachable once all the facts come out in an impeachment hearing would be in the two areas of the NSA spying, which I don't think we've gotten to the bottom of at all, and the other being this incredible abuse of power, overturning the fundamental separation of powers of the Constitution with these signing statements.
We'll explain that.
The Founding Fathers, again, one of the basic principles to protect against dictatorial power in the United States and the rise of a tyrant was that the power to legislate was to be placed in the hands of the people's body, the Congress, and not in the hands of the president, who was only a executive who was supposed to implement the laws passed by Congress. Now, this president has turned that on its head. This president's been in office for 5 years and hasn't vetoed a single bill. Now we know why. Because instead of doing the appropriate thing and saying to Congress, I don't like this bill, I'm not going to sign it, and then going through the process of them having to come up with, you know, the two-thirds vote to override, this president has just quietly, and until he was discovered, nobody knew what he was doing, he quietly did these signing statements saying, well, I'm not going to enact this law, I'm not going to enforce this law, because I'm the commander-in-chief, and I have special powers that say I don't have to obey Congress. The whole purpose of the commander-in-chief in the Constitution is that they wanted to have a civilian at the top of the military, and all it was saying that the president is the boss of the military, not the boss of America and the boss of Congress. What he's done is he's said Congress doesn't matter anymore.
His family and stuff like that, to them he's a real person. I know criminals.
Right.
And they have families, and their families love them. And, you know, so he is a human being.
He's totally, you know, he's a good being. No, but there's no rejoicing in people. Like, we're not talking about Hitler. We're not talking about Stalin here. We're talking about a guy, and it's sad anytime anybody dies. But
definitely,
but from abstractly,
it's not like Dick Cheney had a heart attack.
You know, but it's interesting for a guy 64 years old. Would you rather spend the next 20 years in prison, or would you rather die quickly of a heart attack? That's an interesting question. You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know what the answer.
Do they have subs in prison?
But you know what? They probably wouldn't be that good.
I'm sure they would. Yeah.
No, but you know what they do have now for prison? I got to get it for you guys, but it's awesome. It's this new training handbook guide to how to make it as a straight man in prison.
Oh, really?
And it's all about how you end up having to pick, like, kind of like a big guy, and you're basically his bitch. And it's all about the inner workings and the fundamentals between the relationships.
But then it doesn't seem to be helping you avoid what you're hoping to avoid.
No, but it does, because what it does is it eliminates
you. So you're just one guy's bitch.
Yeah, it eliminates you from being gang raped all the time and, you know, for the disease and being hurt and all
this
stuff.
Oh, so the best bet to maintain to be straight in prison is just to have repeated man-on-man sex, but with one guy.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because they talk about how relationships start to develop, and then because you're then part of this gang, and nobody will screw with you like as part of this gang, but what will happen is you'll kind of want to gain some dominance on other people, so you'll start doing other people in the gang and the whole thing. But there's a tenderness that starts to evolve because men naturally want to feminize, if they're straight, the person that they're doing. So you take on... So the jock has to kind of become emasculated in some way. It's really interesting. They go into really, really vivid graphic detail. So I got to bring it on for you guys.
Okay, first of all, it sounds very homoerotic. Second of all, maybe you should send it to Jeff Skilling because he might be able to use it.
Third of all,
it sounds like a democratic strategy, if I've ever heard one. Well, the way we'll avoid anal sex is by finding a very large Republican and having him deliver it to us every day. That way, you see, we won't be gang raped on a regular basis by all the other Republicans. Yeah, but you see, that kind of defeats the point. Okay. All right, let's go to Tony Snow. Here we go. Tony Snow on Ken Lay.
One other quick one. What has been the president's reaction to the death of Ken Lay?
I really haven't talked to him about it. I'll give you my own personal reaction, which is that when somebody dies, you leave behind those who grieve, and I think they deserve our compassion. But I don't know. What do you think would be the appropriate thing to say?
I don't know. I don't know because the president was his friend.
The president has described Ken Lay as an acquaintance, and many of the president's acquaintances have passed on during his time in office. Again, I think it's sort of an interesting question, but not answerable by me.
Yeah.
Sex? What are you talking about?
Ken Lay.
Is that what?
Yeah, man. Lay.
That's crazy. Sex? Come on.
I don't know Ken Lay.
Look, man, I'm engaged, so.
A lot of people.
None of that.
Mama, friend.
Think about that. That put me in trouble.
Ken Lay, friend. Friend. No, that put me in trouble.
We talking about
I'm the president. That put me in trouble. Ken Lay. Oh, he was my number one contributor over my whole political career?
He's an acquaintance.
Bad acquaintance.
He's an acquaintance.
Friend? I mean, no. You give me a $2 million, I don't know if you get to call me a friend.
No, he's like Apu. He works at the 7-Eleven. I see him every day. Acquaintance. Did Apu die?
My favorite was... A lot of the president's acquaintances have died.
A lot of the president's acquaintances have died.
Well, I suppose that's true.
People are dropping off lights. For example, just yesterday.
Yeah. What am I supposed to say? I mean, Ken Lay.
I don't know. What would be a good answer to that? Yeah. So it turns out there weren't any weapons of mass destruction, and it seems like you guys really had the ability to know that. I don't know. What would be a good answer to that question? I don't know. Do you have an answer?
I don't have an answer. Yeah. We lied. What do you want from me?
Yeah. We're ignoring North Korea. What do you want?
Ken Lay. Yeah. He was the number one contributor to George Bush, and he turned out to be a total criminal who was convicted for 25 years. How do I answer that?
Yeah.
I don't answer it. I try to avoid it and say a lot of the president's acquaintances have died.
Yeah.
There.
The Iran, the neocons totally want to pay for it. How am I supposed to... You want to say that?
How am I supposed to answer
that? How am I supposed to answer that question?
How do you want me to answer? Yes, of course we're going to pay Iran.
There's a calm surrender to the rush of day when the heat of a rolling wind can't be turned away. An enchanted moment, and it sees me through. It's enough for this restless warrior just to be with you. And
Thursday night, President Bush devoted an hour of his 60th birthday to a White House sit-down with a major news organization. It was a rare exercise for the president, who so mistrusts the media filter, he has substantially filtered the media out of his executive routine. But there he was, along with the First Lady, answering questions live to tape on CNN. A million or so viewers caught the broadcast. One of them was Bob.
Larry King? CNN gets an hour with the president and they send Larry King? In cowboy boots, no less. Okay, let's figure the White House wasn't going to let George Bush sit down with John King or Christiane Amanpour or Dr. Sanjay Gupta or anyone else more likely than Larry to hold presidential feet to the fire. So presuming this would be Larry King Live or no Bush exclusive at all, let's give one of broadcasting's most inveterate interviewers the benefit of the doubt. And sure enough, some of the questions were just the ones, say, I would have asked.
So there's no doubt, if you had to do it all over again, knowing that WMDs weren't there, you'd still go in. How well are we prepared if there's another Katrina? Are you optimistic that this Korean thing will be resolved?
Absolutely. I'm optimistic that all problems will be resolved.
The president, alas, wasn't especially revealing. So Larry challenged, interrupted, and repeated the questions relentlessly.
She told me it was not her decision. It was ABC's decision.
But I said...
She held it off for a while. They wanted to do it earlier. Is that true?
Oh, wait. That wasn't Thursday with the president. That was last week with Star Jones Reynolds about her firing from The View. No, with the president, Larry was as relentful as can be.
Al Gore was on recently on this program, and concerning the environment, he said, President Bush and Vice President Cheney have anointed to every key position that has anything to do with climate change, special interest spokesman for the oil companies, coal companies. And this is no secret. How do you respond to that? Have you seen his film?
No, I haven't seen it yet, but yeah, I guess politics never stops.
Politics, Larry? After the president stopped rambling about ethanol or whatever, couldn't he have brought up the Kyoto Treaty he won't sign? What about censoring NASA scientists who acknowledge global warming? Yeah, first questions are great, but journalism isn't about going down the list. It's about following up and getting answers. An hour with the president squandered this way is just so frustrating. The thing about a free press is either use it or lose it. A point made painfully clear when Larry raised the president's attack on the New York Times for informing the public about how private bank records are routinely tracked in the war on terror.
It doesn't make any sense to me to give the enemy, our game plan on how we're going to deal with them.
Isn't that a ticklish line, though, free press? You've got to support a free press.
I do support a free press strongly. I also want people to recognize that we're at war. And I just don't understand. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Laura, we asked emails, and one came in for you. I read that you were once a librarian.
Yes, Mrs. Bush. Do tell. Inquiring minds want to know.
Not by being aggressive, but by being passive, but sort of getting people to open up in different ways. Larry King does not get you to open up in different ways. He just asks you incredibly softball questions. Alessandra Stanley of the New York Times referred to him as more of a hotel concierge than a interrogator.
You keep saying concierge. Isn't it just concierge?
No, you got to soften the G a little, but I'm trying not to sound like an ass.
Oh, okay.
But concierge, sure. I mean, you could, yeah. But it's
just we're in America now. We're not in Paris.
All right, the valet.
Okay, yeah. The valet at the concierge. Yeah, that's all what right, it is. Right. Okay.
So, right, and so yesterday, so Larry King said, "I don't know what my first question will be," and we thought, oh, "We know what your first question will be.
It's your birthday. You're 60. How do you feel?"
And we said that on the air. And let's see what Larry King did when he asked his first question of the president and Laura Bush.
Huh. Indeed.
President George W. Bush and Laura Bush, the occasion is the president's 60th birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you, sir.
What does it feel like?
No. I'm pretty good.
Feel good, as a matter of fact.
Not really.
So we get off to a tough start, a grilling start.
You know, look, Larry set himself up for that. It's not like a tough interview could have started with, hey, you're 60 today, how do you feel? Sure. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with asking the question. But let's not pretend like it hadn't occurred to you what your first question was going to be. I don't know whether I'm going to come in with him there on the weapons of mass destruction or, you know, whether I'm going to hammer him with Sam Alito or anything or, you know, executive privilege, anything like that, or warrantless wiretapping and breaking the FISA law. Come on. How's it feel? You're 60.
Shockingly, he didn't ask him about executive privilege.
Yeah, it's weird.
I thought
something that Larry is aware of.
Yeah, I thought he was a bit of an expert on that. No? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, but he did ask him about the newspaper stories. You know how the New York Times, Wall Street Journal and the LA Times.
And the Washington Post, Dana Priest breaking the Gulag story, all those things, or in that same conversation, maybe Larry didn't refer to it specifically, but the Washington Post has broken a story also which conservatives have said warrant prison time for reporters.
But specifically the Swift story about the banking and how we're following the banking transactions. So Larry asked him about that, and the president had an answer that's, not true. So that's fun. Let's play that.
He blamed the New York Times, but the LA Times also printed that story about intercepting, and also... The Wall Street Journal printed it.
Disclosure is disclosure. I don't think I've blamed any paper by name. Maybe I have.
You did name the New York Times.
I did?
I think.
I don't know if I did or didn't, but anyway.
You did. I don't know if I did. I don't remember what
I said. Did I say to blame? Did I blame papers? I don't blame papers. This, quoting Bush earlier, the disclosure of this program is disgraceful. We're at war with a bunch of people who want to hurt the United States of America, and for people to leak that program and for a newspaper to publish it does great harm to the United States of America. Okay. And he also mentioned the New York Times later. All right, so fun for everybody. That's a nice start to it. Then we get into problems and who might have created the problems. Listen carefully at this one. Now, if you're on the YoungTurks.com, you're going to see it. You can hear it just as well, of course, on the radio. Listen carefully for who's created the problems.
I look at life as a series of opportunities to make this world a better place. One reason there's problems is because we've confronted them. In other words, the status quo was unacceptable to me. And therefore, it's important to deal with problems before they become acute.
One of the reasons we have problems is because we've created them,
yeah.
Is kind of what he wanted to say, but they confronted them. But again, there's really no difference there. He's saying we created the problem.
Yes, he's just there turning it around. We confronted the problem, therefore we created it. I mean, therefore it's that's the only reason why it's a problem. You know, Jill and you to a lesser extent, but you know, you get into reading the people's minds more than I'm certainly comfortable with. But man, I can't help but do it there with Laura, because she looks like the parent of a child at the spelling bee.
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, you nailed it. Like, please get it right.
Get it right. Get it right. Get it right. Oh, please. Oh. We worked so hard on this. Yay!
Or in that case.
Oh, yeah.
No. Legal is spelled L-E-G-A-L, not L-E-J-A-L. All right. So, yeah, she looks so uncomfortable.
Yeah,
it's great. Look at her. Look at her. Like, please.
She is so much smarter than he is. I like her fine. I don't know that she's particularly bright, but I have nothing against Laura.
All right. So now we get on to a real question, Ken Lay. And, you know, I think King does a halfway decent job of pressing him on this a little bit, way.
Look, Larry King's soft peddling of stuff does lead people to let their guard down sometimes, and they occasionally make mistakes. And Larry King, and I think Ken Lay is one of the examples where King actually elicited information that we previously did not have.
Yeah,
The New York Times, Alessandra Stanley didn't point that out, but I think this was one of, or maybe she did point it out actually.
No,
I think was revealing, and George Bush did let his guard down, and maybe that doesn't happen if you're giving an antagonizing interview.
Remember,
aggressive interview.
Just yesterday, we showed you the Tony Snow clip where he was like, Ken Lay. I mean, maybe they're an acquaintance.
Well, here, I have it. I have the transcript here. Tony Snow says to a reporter, what would be the appropriate thing to say about how the White House is reacting to Ken Lay's heart attack and death? And the reporter says, I don't know. I don't know Ken Lay. The president was his friend, not me. And Tony Snow says, no, the president has described Ken Lay as an acquaintance, and many of the president's acquaintances have passed on.
All right, now here's Larry King and George Bush talking about that same acquaintance, if you will, Ken Lay.
I was very surprised
about his death.
You know, Mike, my hope is that his heart was right with the Lord, and I feel real sorry for his wife. She's had a rough go, and she's now here on earth to bear the burdens of losing her husband, a man she loved. And
is that whole thing, the whole Enron story, shocking to you?
Yeah, so.
Because, I mean, you knew him pretty well from Texas, right?
Pretty well, pretty well. I knew him. I got to know him. People don't believe this, but he actually supported Ann Richards in the 94 campaign.
She told me that.
She did?
She liked him a lot.
Yeah, he's a good guy. And so what I did was we had a business council, and I kept him on as the chairman of the business council. And, you know, got to know him and got to see him in action. One of the things I respected him for was he was such a contributor to Houston civil society. He was a generous person. I'm disappointed that, you know, that there was this... And he betrayed the trust of shareholders.
Yeah, that's not an acquaintance.
Yeah. First of all, he was his number one contributor throughout his career. Yeah, and a little bit more than an acquaintance.
Yeah.
You know him a little bit better than just in passing.
But that is far more than any reporter has ever gotten out of George Bush on what his relationship was with Ken Lay. Now, maybe that
he
was...
He said he's a good guy.
Respect him.
No, he was going to say
no, and then he said one of the things I respect him for was the contributions to Houston. Right, he was headed toward respect him, and he cut himself off.
Right, and he said a lot of positive things about Ken Lay there, and at the end he said...
He was a good guy, he says.
Yeah.
He was a good guy.
And he said, yeah, it was unfortunate the way he betrayed the trust of the shareholders. And that was revealing. I mean, clearly he knows him very well, and then later King asked Laura Bush, and Laura Bush said, yeah, I know his wife, et cetera. The other thing that I get out of this, and, you know, that's obviously the relevant part of that question. The other thing I get out of it is, I mean, just, as a friend of mine says, just look at him.
Bush, you mean?
Yeah. Bush. I mean, when you, you can hear it too, but especially as you see him struggle for the words and try to say the right thing and often say the wrong thing. And then every once in a while he says something that he thinks is clever.
Right, he can't help but his face betrays his glee.
Right, when he said, like, I hope he's right with the Lord. Yeah. And then he looks up like, hey, that wasn't bad.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah.
Right. He reeks of stupidity.
Yeah.
And I don't care what anybody says.
No.
Just look at him.
No, look at him. There's no question.
And just listen to him talk. It's oozing out of every pore.
Yeah, just and you know, and it's because I wonder, and I, you know, I spent so many years as a reporter but we still interview people, of course, but it's with a different sort of set of marching orders as a talk show host than as a reporter. And I don't know whether to give Larry King credit or not. My hunch is it's accidental. But when he has his arms folded together and he comes in with the, oh, Ann Richards says that she really liked him. I mean, if it's genius, it's to get George Bush to relax and open himself up. Like, oh, she did? Yeah, he was a good guy. And then he just called Ken Lay a good guy.
Yeah.
I think it's accidental. I think Larry King wants to say, look, I talked to Ann Richards, too.
Totally.
I talk to everybody. Everybody talks to me. I'm the man. So I think that's what it is, yeah.
Of course it is.
But, you know, and Larry wants to be, of course, he's on the inside. The interesting thing is there also could have been some strategic decision by the White House, which is, you know what, admitting your whatever, we don't have to deny the relationship with Ken Lay nearly as hard now because he's dead, and the zest of pursuing that story and look at what a bad guy Ken Lay is, that won't work because people don't want to cheer someone's death. So,
yeah, that's probably a good point, too. All right, now we go on to Osama bin Laden. He's apparently thinking about him every day.
Yeah.
I think that's what's going to come across.
Well, of course, remember the last time also we asked about Osama bin Laden, there was the essentially, what, who? I don't even think about it.
I'm unconcerned.
I'm unconcerned with Osama bin Laden. That was back in, I believe, 2000. That might have been 2002.
I'll give you the quotes and the dates from our website after we listen to this.
All right,
clip.
But here's George Bush yesterday talking to Larry King on Osama bin Laden.
Can we get bin Laden?
Yeah, we'll get him. Yeah, we'll get him.
Yeah.
What's the big... Why has it been so hard?
Because it's a big...
5 years coming.
It's a big... It is 5 years.
More than that, really.
But let me decide. One way to look at it is, is he in charge of the vast amount of folks that he was in charge of before? They got training, so, you know, places in the safe haven? The answer is no. They got him on the run, and they're hiding.
Wow.
I, of course, would like to bring him to justice. But we'll get him. We're just a matter of persistence and patience. Every day I think about this.
Not getting
every day. Well, every day I think about Al-Qaeda. Every day I think about protecting this country. I mean, every day. the thought has not... the thought has entered my mind, and I think about it, and talk to people about it, and strategize about it every day.
Obsessed with it?
No. Well, in a way, yeah, I guess you could say obsessed. But obsession isn't the wrong word. Doing my duty.
That's the right word.
That's what the American people expect.
He's got it again.
They expect this government to protect them.
I'm going to need this.
And so long as there's an enemy lurking out there, you know, I'm going to talk to people, work with people. I have an intel briefing every morning.
You're the president!
And we talk about what we know, what we don't know, what we need to do better. We talk about plots. Uh-huh. We talk about things we might have heard or read. And we're responding, and it is the calling of our time to win this war on terror.
Okay. First of all, when he said it's a duty, he did it again. He had that gleam in his eye, like, "Oh, I got it. I found a word that kind of fits here."
It's my job. It's my duty.
It's my duty.
Duty.
I read. We read. We talk.
We talk about things we've read. Not you. Believe me, not you.
Every day. We do it every day.
I get the intelligence briefing every day. Like, that fact surprised him when he became president. He like this on day two of his presidency, on January 22nd, 2001, right? When the guy came in to give him the intelligence briefing, maybe it was Condoleezza Rice, maybe it was some deputy, right? He was like, "Oh, we don't know. I had this yesterday." And they're like, "No, it's a new one today." He's like, "Oh, really?"
I get one every day?
Every day. I thought, like, monthly, maybe.
It's like, I ought to mention that a lot.
I would tell people that. Do people know I get this every day?
So, before we go off this, and we got a couple more clips for you from a press conference and from Larry King as well, I just want to say it's a talking point. That Karl Rove has told him, hey, mention that you're concerned about this and that you talk about this every day. So people will say, hey, look, the president's really concerned.
I am honestly sympathetic to the people like Karl Rove in certain situations like this, because they want to emphasize that he does it every day. But they can't hear that answer and think, good. They can only hear that answer and go, George, Jesus Christ, act like people know something about being president. Act like you don't know less about being president than most Americans.
By the way, let me give you some quotes. March 13th, 2002, President Bush says, I don't know where bin Laden is. I have no idea and really don't care. It's not that important. It's not our priority.
Every day.
Direct quote in 2002. I'll give you another one. On that same day, March 13th, 2002. I am truly not that concerned about him.
Yeah.
I thought it was every day. I guess you must have taken March 13th, 2002 off. I guess it wasn't that day that you were concerned about him.
Posted in the spring of 2004, and it was adapted from the introduction to the deluxe election edition Bushisms. It's called The Misunderestimated Man, and it's written and read by Jacob Weisberg.
The question I am most frequently asked about Bushisms is, do you really think the President of the United States is dumb? The short answer is yes. The long answer is yes and no. Quotations collected over the years in Slate may leave the impression that George W. Bush is a dimwit. Let's face it, a man who cannot talk about education without making a humiliating grammatical mistake, the illiteracy level of our children are appalling, who cannot keep straight the three branches of government, it's the executive's branch to interpret the law, who coins ridiculous words, Hispanos, arbalist, subliminable, resignate, transformation, who habitually says the opposite of what he intends. The death tax is good for people from all walks of life. Sounds like a grade-A imbecile. And if you don't care to pursue the matter any further, that view will suffice. George W. Bush has governed, for the most part, the way any airhead might, undermining the fiscal condition of the nation, squandering the goodwill of the world after September 11th, and allowing huge problems, global warming, entitlement spending, AIDS, to metastasize toward catastrophe through a combination of ideology, incomprehension, and indifference. If Bush isn't exactly the moron he sounds, his synaptic misfirings offer a plausible proxy for the idiocy of his presidency. In reality, however, there's more to it. Bush's assorted malapropisms, solecisms, gaffes, spoonerisms, and truisms tend to imply that his lack of fluency in English is tantamount to an absence of intelligence. But as we all know, the inarticulate can be shrewd, the fluent fatuous. In Bush's case, the symptoms point to a specific malady, some kind of linguistic deficit akin to dyslexia, that does not indicate a lack of mental capacity per se. Bush also compensates with his nonverbal acumen. As he notes, smart comes in all kinds of different ways. The president's way is an aptitude for connecting to people through banter and physicality. He has a powerful memory for names, details, and figures that truly matter to him, such as batting averages from the 1950s. Bush also has a keen political sense, sharpened under the tutelage of Karl Rove. What's more, calling the president a cretin absolves him of responsibility. Like Reagan, Bush avoids blame for all manner of contradictions, implausible assertions, and outright lies by appearing an amiable dunce. If he knows not what he does, blame goes to the three puppeteers, Cheney, Rove, and Rumsfeld. It also breeds sympathy. We wouldn't laugh at FDR because he couldn't walk. Is it less cruel to laugh at GWB because he can't talk? The soft bigotry of low expectations means Bush is seen to outperform by merely getting by. Finally, elitist condescension, however merited, helps cement Bush's bond to the masses. But if numbskull is an imprecise description of the president, it is not altogether inaccurate. Bush may not have been born stupid, but he has achieved stupidity, and now he wears it as a badge of honor. What makes mocking this president fair as well as funny is that Bush is, or at least once was, capable of learning, reading, and thinking. We know he has discipline and can work hard, at least when the goal is reducing his time for a 3-mile run. Instead, he chose to coast, for most of his life, on name, charm, good looks, and the easy access to capital afforded by family connections. The most obvious expression of Bush's choice of ignorance is that at the age of 57, he knows nothing about policy or history. After years of working as his dad's spear chucker in Washington, he didn't understand the difference between Medicare and Medicaid, the second and third largest federal programs. Well into his plans for invading Iraq, Bush still couldn't get down the distinction between Sunni and Shiite Muslims, the key religious divide in a country he was about to occupy. Though he sometimes carries books for show, he either doesn't read them or doesn't absorb anything from them. Bush's ignorance is so transparent that many of his intimates do not bother to dispute it even in public. Consider the testimony of several who know him well. Richard Perle, foreign policy advisor. The first time I met Bush 43, two things became clear. One, he didn't know very much. The other was that he had the confidence to ask questions that revealed he didn't know much. David Frum, former speechwriter. Bush had a poor memory for facts and figures. Fire a question at him about the specifics of his administration's policies, and he often appeared uncertain. Nobody would ever enroll him in a quiz show. Laura Bush, spouse. George is not an overly introspective person. He has good instincts and he goes with them. He doesn't need to evaluate and reevaluate a decision. He doesn't try to overthink. He likes action. Paul O'Neill, former Treasury Secretary. The only way I can describe it is that, well, the president is like a blind man in a room full of deaf people. There is no discernible connection. A second, more damning aspect of Bush's mindset is that he doesn't want to know anything in detail, however important. Since college, he has spilled with contempt for knowledge, equating learning with snobbery, and making a joke of his own anti-intellectualism. William F. Buckley wrote a book at Yale. I read one, he quipped at a black tie event. By O'Neill's account, Bush could sit through an hour-long presentation about the state of the economy without asking a single question. I was bored as hell, the president shot back, ostensibly in jest. Closely related to this aggressive ignorance is a third feature of Bush's mentality, laziness. Again, this is a lifelong trait. Bush's college grades were mostly C's, including a 73 in Introduction to the American Political System. At the start of one term, the star of the Yale football team spotted him in the back row during the shopping period for courses. Hey, George Bush is in this class, Calvin Hill shouted to his teammates. This is the one for us. As governor of Texas, Bush would take a long break in the middle of his short workday for a run, followed by a stretch of video golf or computer solitaire. A fourth and final quality of Bush's mind is that it does not think. The president can't tolerate debate about issues. Offered an opinion, he makes up his mind quickly and never reconsiders. At an elementary school, a child once asked him whether it was hard to make decisions as president. "Most of the decisions come pretty easily to me, to be frank with you," he said. By leaping to conclusions based on what he believes, Bush avoids contemplating even the most obvious basic contradictions between his policy of tax cuts and reducing the deficit, between his call for a humble foreign policy based on alliances and his unilateral assertion of American power, between his support for in vitro fertilization, which destroys embryos, and his opposition to fetal stem cell research, because it destroys embryos. Why would someone capable of being smart choose to be stupid? To understand, you have to look at W's relationship with his father. This filial bond involves more tension than meets the eye. Dad was away for much of his oldest son's childhood. Little George grew up closer to his acid-tongued mother and acted out against the absent parent through adolescent misbehavior, academic failure, dissipation, and basically not accomplishing anything at all until well into his 40s. W's youthful screw-ups and smart-aleck attitude reflect some combination of protest, plea for attention, and flailing attempt to compete. Until a decade ago, his resume read like a send-up of his dad's. Bush Sr. was a star student at Andover and Phi Beta Kappa at Yale, where he was also captain of the baseball team. Jr. struggled through with gentleman C's, and though he loved baseball, he couldn't make the college lineup. Father was a bomber pilot in the Pacific. Son sat out Nam in the Texas Air National Guard, where he lost flying privileges by not showing up. Dad drove to Texas in 1947 to get rich in the oil business, and actually did. Son tried the same in 1975 and drilled dry holes for a decade. Bush the Elder got elected to Congress in 1966. Shrub ran in 1978, didn't know what he was talking about, and got clobbered. Through all this incompetent emulation runs an undercurrent of hostility. In an oft-told anecdote circa 1973, G.W.B., after getting wasted at a party and driving over a neighbor's trash can in Houston, challenged his dad. "I hear you're looking for me," W. told the chairman of the Republican National Committee. "You want to go mano a mano right here?" Some years later at a state dinner, he told the Queen of England he was being seated far away because he was the black sheep of the family. After half a lifetime of this kind of frustration, Bush decided to straighten up. Nursing a hangover at a 40th birthday party weekend, he gave up wild turkey, cold turkey. With the help of Billy Graham, he put himself in the hands of a higher power and began going to church. He became obsessed with punctuality and developed a rigid routine. Thus did Prince Hal molt into an evangelical King Henry. And it worked. Putting together a deal to buy the Texas Rangers, the ne'er-do-well finally tasted success. With success, he grew closer to his father, taking on the role of family avenger. This culminated in his 1994 challenge to Texas Governor Ann Richards, who had twitted Dad at the 1988 Democratic Convention. Curiously, this late arrival at adulthood did not involve Bush becoming in any way thoughtful. Having chosen stupidity as rebellion, he stuck with it out of conformity. The promise-keeper, reformed alky path he chose not only drastically curtailed personal choices he no longer wanted, it also supplied an all-encompassing order, offered guidance on policy, and prevented the need for much actual information. Bush's old answer to hard questions was, "I don't know and who cares?" His new answer was, "Wait a second while I check with Jesus." A remaining bit of poignancy was his unresolved struggle with his father. "All I ask," he implored a reporter while running for governor in 1994, "is that for once you guys stop seeing me as the son of George Bush." In his campaigns, W. has kept his dad off stage. In an exceptional appearance on the eve of the 2000 New Hampshire primary, 41 came on stage and called his son, "This boy." While some describe the second Bush presidency as a restoration, it is, in at least equal measure, a repudiation. The son's harder-edged conservatism explicitly rejects the old man's approach to such issues as abortion, taxes, and relations with Israel. This Oedipally-induced ignorance expresses itself most dangerously in Bush's handling of the war in Iraq. W. polished off his old man's greatest enemy, Saddam, but only by lampooning 41's accomplishment of coalition building in the first Gulf War. Bush led the country to war on false pretenses and neglected to plan the occupation that would inevitably follow. A more knowledgeable and engaged president might have questioned the quality of the evidence about Iraq's supposed weapons programs. one who preferred to be intelligent might have asked about the possibility of an unfriendly reception. Instead, Bush rolled the dice. His budget-busting tax cuts exemplify a similar phenomenon, driven by an alternate set of ideologues. As the president says, we misunderestimate him. He was not born stupid. He chose stupidity. Bush may look like a well-meaning dolt. On consideration, he's something far more dangerous, a dedicated fool.
Thanks for listening, everybody. All right, tomorrow's the big day. You can all start warming up your printing presses or reel-to-reel players or 8-tracks or whatever it is you're going to use to, you know, copy and distribute tomorrow's show. Now, last time I talked about having the best show ever, it was about 80% based on the fact that some parts of it made me cry laughing. That is not the case with tomorrow's show. That's why I chose to refer to it as an important show. So just so we're clear on that, it's not all fun and games, but it's good and necessary and important, and I strongly encourage and hope that you will help pass along the word in any way you see fit. In the meantime, there's just a couple more days of the podcast awards nomination process. You can find out information about that at my website, bestoftheleftpodcast.com. Basically, they're just, I meant to talk about this a little bit more than I did, but oh well. Basically it's awards for podcasting, and, you know, I figure there really aren't that many political shows out there compared to, you know, like comedy or something like that. So, you know, it seems like decent enough chance that I might get myself in there. So if you like the show, want to help out and, you know, winning or nominating or, you know, whatever the case may be, any kind of exposure is really the goal of a program like that for me anyways. So anyways, you can find out how to do that, how to help out. I think the closing day is the 15th of this month. And I don't know if that means midnight of that day or whatever, but you can check that out nonetheless. Aside from the podcast awards, there's a whole host of other ways that you can either, you know, help or support or contribute, you know, your thoughts and ideas or whatever you'd like to do. For the show, go to bestoftheleftpodcast.com. There's a whole section on the page there. It says support the show. You can click all of those links. Anything you do along those lines is greatly appreciated. And of course, direct emails always get read by me, usually right away, because I am stuck in front of my computer for a vast amount of time. Or vast stretches of time during the day. So you can do all of that from the website, and if you want to email direct, it's hippiesympathizer@gmail.com. As they say, it's good enough for government work. Have a good one, everybody.
Hi, this is Nancy of Wake Up AM, Wake Up America Podcast. Kathy, Meg, and I are proud to be members of the Progressive Podcast Network. Check out all of the great podcasts over at newmediarevolution.org. The Progressive Podcast Network. Stick a fork in the mainstream media because they're done.
Period. And if that leads to a fucking impeachment, then so fucking be it.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at caskers.com.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.